Okay, so our family scripture, which is over here, talks and likens us to stones and to bricks. Okay, and it says that now he, that being God, is fitting us in brick by brick and stone by stone with Christ Jesus as the cornerstone that holds all of us together. And by being here today, it's kind of like he has created within the space here and now a temple, a place where he is most at home and really comfortable. So because of his word, we know that the Spirit of God is here with us. And I think that's really exciting. Stones are mentioned quite a few times, quite a lot actually, in the Bible. And Jesus mentions it at one stage too. And I really like this. And we had a bit of a laugh this morning and figured that there was the first sort of inkling of Osh back when Jesus was entering into Jerusalem, because one of the Pharisees came out, and I don't know if you remember that all the people were praising Jesus, and they had their palms and their cloaks, and they were waving them and putting them on the ground, and they were shouting and praising God, and the Pharisees said, if you could just keep the people quiet, please, you know, it's a bit noisy. The first bit of noise control came around. If they had had high vis vests and cones, I'm sure they would have created the place for Jesus to walk. And Jesus said, you know, I could stop the people from praising me, but even the rocks will cry out and worship me. So he's kind of there declaring that all of creation wants to worship God. So isn't it exciting that even if a rock, you know, but we have the freedom to worship God. Where we live today, we have the freedom to praise and worship God and to declare his goodness and his glory. And I think that's really cool. Okay, now, as we were going through, Guy and I were going through the Bible, we found quite a lot of examples of how the stone, or a stone, the story with the stone in it, leads us and points us to Jesus. And we got really excited and we found some stories that we wanted to share with you, but we got so excited that we had to actually end up whittling it right down. We had decided that we're going to do a bit of a tag team. There are 7 points. But we're going to bring it down to 3. So we are going to be passing the microphone back and forth. Okay, if someone was to ask you today, right here, right now, what is God doing in your life? I wonder what your response would be. To answer it succinctly is really quite difficult. Because the truth of the matter is that your today, our today, is made up of a yesterday, and that our story is going to continue and conclude tomorrow. But the thing is that right here and right now, we are in the middle of our story. We're right in the thick of things. And I don't know about you, but being in the here and now can be a really tricky and a really challenging time. Yet, it's at this time of all times that we remember that we have a yesterday and that we have a tomorrow. Because as we look back to our yesterday, we are encouraged and we are strengthened to face our todays, and we're given hope for our tomorrow. Now, the perfect example of this story is the story of the Israelites. And as you may remember, if we go right back to the beginning of the book, under Joseph, the Israelites had a really fantastic life. Things were great. There was favor for them. But after his death, things didn't go so well. And the Israelites find themselves enslaved in bondage and in slavery in Egypt. And it's a really awful time for them. And they cry out to God. They're like, God, where are you? And God hears them, and God responds to them. And in his perfect timing, he sends Moses. And we read of the amazing things that God did, all those miracles. He proves his power and his might and his love for the Israelites. And he brings them out of slavery. And eventually, with those miraculous things, they're brought out. But then they come to the Red Sea. and how on earth are they going to get across? The only way for them to cross the Red Sea was for God to make a way for them. And he did. The group of people that had left Egypt were now finding themselves walking across the seabed miraculously. How amazing was that? But as they turned around, they looked and they saw coming from behind them the Egyptian army. What were they going to do? They ran, they got to the other side of the shore, and then they saw the mighty hand of God that had held those waters was removed, and the Egyptian army was washed away. Can you imagine the Israelites on that shore? They would have been so excited. They would have been like, oh God, you came through and we're so grateful and thank you. And they were praising him. And in there today, they were so excited. But then the next day, they forgot their yesterday. Because there they are and they're like, well, this isn't what we've signed up for. Where's Moses? Where's the food? Where's the water? What is this all about? This land of milk and honey? This isn't it. This is so not what I thought it was all about. They'd forgotten their yesterday. They were living in the moment of today. They forgot what their tomorrow was to come. And so they took their eyes off God. And we know that the consequence for them doing that was that they were not to enter into the promised land. We know that two men were going to make it through, or made it through, and that was Joshua and Caleb. And the reason why they did make it through was because they remembered what God had done, and they remembered what God was going to do. So it's kind of like it's at this point where God enters into their story to talk about a stone. And he says to Joshua, just as they're about to cross the river again, to enter into the promised land, I've got something that I want you to do. I want you to choose 12 men, one from each of the tribes, and I want when they come to the middle of the riverbed, I want you to get them to pick up a stone that would have been bigger than this. And they had to carry it, and they had to take it to the other side of the shore. So, as we know, God's mighty hand stopped the water. The people walked over the riverbed to the other side and they arrived stone in hand, kind of like us this morning, stone in hand. See, those stones would become a reminder to the people, not only to them, but to their children, to the generations to come, for all of mankind. A reminder of what God had done yesterday, of how mighty and of how powerful he was. And to remember what that was, what that was like back then, so that as you stand in today, they can face what they had to face to enter into the promised land. Because the thing is, this wasn't the end of the story for them. It's kind of like, that saying, but wait, there's more. There's more to come. And you're going to be able to enter into this promised land, you're going to have to remember the things that I've done. Because it will strengthen you and sustain you for today so that you can face what has to come for you to enter into the promised land. We're here now because of what God has done for us. He has made a way for us to be here, just like he made a way for the Israelites to enter into their promised land. And that way is the cross. That is our yesterday. Actually, it's not just our yesterday, it is our today and our tomorrow as well. God loves us so much that he gave us his son. He sacrificed his son, Jesus, so that we could have relationship with him, so that our sins could be forgiven, and we could walk in the freedom of the new life that he has for us. So our testimony, too, is that, like the Israelites, of God's goodness, of his graciousness, of his faithfulness and of his love. So those 12 stones collected were to remind the Israelites of their journey thus far. God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And the same is true for us here and now. You know, it can be so easy for us to look at our situation and our circumstances of what's happening in our lives that we can forget the mighty hand of God that has brought us this far. And as we focus on the here and now, sometimes we can forget to look up and to look forward. It takes faith to step into the promises of God. It takes courage. It takes determination. And it's all about knowing and trusting God, walking with Him through it. For us to be able to take a moment to remember for ourselves where God has brought us, the things that He has done. Not only to remind ourselves, but as we begin to share the things that God has done in our lives with others, it builds up our faith, but it also builds up the faith of those around us. And that was the reason for those memorial stones, to remind us, to strengthen us, so that as we stand here today, we can go, I can face tomorrow because God is for me. He is with me. He has plans and He has purposes for me to walk into, and I can do that. I can do that because He is with me and He is for me. So we're going to hold tight to our stone to remember.
Nobody really likes to have an enemy, do they? I certainly don't. I'm one of those non-confrontational people. Kate will probably affirm that. But it could be said that we do have enemies, perhaps not in the form that we typically may think of those things as being. The word enemy crops up in the Bible quite a few times, and there are several iterations of it in Hebrew. And one of them, which lends itself to this message this morning, is spelled T-S-A-R, which I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but I think it's Tsar. Is that Tsar? Tsar. It's got a T there, but it's Tsar. That word in Hebrew means oppressor. And that's the context in which I want to talk this morning about enemies. In the time of King Saul, the Philistines sought to oppress the Israelites. And they did this in an interesting way. They spearheaded their oppression by using a giant whose name was Goliath. Now, I've got a prop this morning just to help us get an idea about this guy. So just a minute. So in 1 Samuel, yeah. It tells us that he stood over 9 foot tall. I've taken a little bit of artistic license this morning. I'm not sure about the Philistines, what sort of gear they wore for battle, but say he had a little bit of a spike on his head. This stick is getting on towards 10 foot. So imagine there's a little spike on his helmet, if you will. The only letdown on this prop is, of course, that no one's going to be intimidated by a stick figure, are they? So that's where it falls down. But, I mean, that's an impressive piece of man, isn't it? Who stood... Okay, we'll have to work on that one. It wasn't enough time to build a full-scale model, okay? You'll sort of forgive me for that. So anyway, we read in 1 Samuel in verses, chapter 17 and verses 8 to 11. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man. Let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Not a bad deal, you may think. Here they are offering to reduce the casualties by having two men meet in mortal combat. By so doing, it would be great, wouldn't it? We know all the casualties of war and the outcomes of that. But really, this is exactly what the Philistines wanted, because what they wanted was as many slaves as they could capture. So they reduced the casualty rate by putting up their warrior against anyone that would take him on. In spite of their name, Philistines, I don't know if you, when we think of Philistine, we often think of someone that's uncultured, uncouth, so forth and so on, but actually the Philistines were quite a technically advanced group of people. And in fact, they were so advanced that they superseded the Israelites at the time in their knowledge of metals. The Israelites used a lot of brass and, was it brass or was it bronze? I think it might have been bronze, actually. But the Philistines, they used iron. And because they had iron and technology to make weapons and to keep them sharp and so forth, the Israelites were kind of reliant on them for that. So there was this kind of strange symbiotic relationship between the two people, even though they were actually opposed to one another. Beware if you have a giant camped on your doorstep, as they did. They don't all go around by the name of Goliath, do they? If you have such an enemy camped on your doorstep, you'll know it. He's that big, ugly, hairy guy. He's standing head and shoulders above everything else in your life, and he demands your attention. He doesn't always go under the name of Goliath, though. He can go under different names, like fear, or anger, or lust, or selfishness, pride. The list can go on and on. You fill in the blanks. A giant really is anything in our life that gets to epic proportions and then becomes dominant and oppressive in our lives. Like the Israelites, we can kind of coexist with that, can't we? We can make deals along the way. But unfortunately, that just leads to further enslavement. Because getting what we one often can actually only tend to feed that giant and make it grow bigger. However, help is at hand, and no matter how long or for how much that enemy has become entrenched in our lives, we can overcome him and we can gain freedom. It is possible. By the time David arrives at the front lines, the Philistines and the Israelites had been in a standoff for over 40 days. And David turns up. His father Jesse has sent him to bring food and to see how his three older brothers are doing. So he turns up and he's sort of mooching about at the front line, as you do, and he gets word around the ranks that there's an offer, a reward, to the man that can deal with this giant Goliath. Well, he's quite interested in that. When we read, we find out that he actually inquires more than once. He inquires twice as to what these rewards are. What's on offer here? And so he gets drawn into the centre of the story, into that arena, through his interest, not only in that, but in two ways. So when we want to deal with giants in our lives, we need to be enticed by the rewards on offer. Now, those rewards look like joy, peace, and hope, and love, and all those things. They must supersede what the giant may be offering to us, which is not those things at all, those things that pull us down in life. So David finds out, and I think, you know, he was quite taken with the fact that King Saul would offer all these gifts to the person that would overcome Goliath. But also he knew something else. There were two ways that he was enticed. The other thing was that Goliath had challenged the people of Israel and the God they served. And he was going to challenge that himself by meeting with Goliath. So So he goes to Saul and he says, look, Saul, this is my CV. Tom would have been proud. Tom O'Neill could have written it himself. And he lets Saul know how he's qualified to do the job to take out Goliath. And Saul listens, and with the best of intentions, he almost signs David's death warrant. This is what it says in verses 38 to 39. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around. Because he was not used to them, he said, I cannot go in these because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. God had already prepared David for the commission. He didn't need someone else coming along and putting something on him to try and equip him to do the job. He knew the way in which God was going to fight the battle on his behalf. And he didn't need an ill-fitting garment put on him that was just going to encumber him and probably bring about his demise. I'm not saying that we need to go into battle alone. In fact, we need to stand shoulder to shoulder. One of the tactics of the enemy is that he tends to isolate people. And when he isolates people, he can then eliminate them. So that's not what this message is about. But in this instance, because the Israelites were so terrified and stood back, it took one man to go forward knowing that God had called him to do that. So what does he do? David then takes his shepherd's bag and he goes down and he picks up 5 smooth stones and puts them in his bag. Again, my props fall a bit short this morning. I haven't got a staff and I don't have a sling. But if you can just imagine that, that would be good. So he's now equipped to go out and meet his enemy. For anyone that's battling a giant in their life, it can be hard, hard work, can't it? It can really wear you down. If you don't know what God's given you to use, you can use your own strength, your own goodness, your own self-righteousness. And what that looks like is you reach into your bag and one by one you use up your 5 stones. And once you've used up your 5 stones, you grab anything else at hand, bar the kitchen sink, because you're that desperate to do away with the giant on your doorstep. But I said that in life, that it is possible to have real freedom. There was a stone in David's bag that he knew would take out the giant, and he only needed 1 stone, didn't he? I don't know why he picked up 5, but he only needed the 1. And that stone had written on it, the battle is the Lord's, and that's the key. We can do things in our own strength, but the battle is the Lord's. Using anything else is just going to wear us out and we'll meet with defeat and discouragement. In the Message version of the Bible, in Matthew 11, in verses 28 to 30, this is what Jesus says. And just think of what I've just spoken about and now hear what Jesus says about the battle. Are you tired, worn out, burnt out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn how to live freely and lightly. We are in a spiritual battle. But we need to recognize the nature of our warfare. Our victory comes through a relationship with Jesus. Trying to steer down our enemy is just going to wear us out. We need to fix our eyes on Christ. He's the one that fights on our behalf. He's the one that's already won the victory. You know, we overcome by the blood of the Lamb, don't we? and the word of our testimony. And when we do truly overcome the enemy by the blood of the Lamb, he gives us our voice back. He gives us a testimony to say, it is Christ that has done this on my behalf. It is not by my own effort or self-will, because that's just going to wear you out. But when you allow him, it's amazing what Christ can do in bringing true freedom.
So we have these stones. We have stones that remind us of the might and of the power and the presence of God for the Israelites, and the might and the power and the presence of God for where he has brought us. We have these stones in our hands which remind us that the battle is the Lord's. Not ours, it's his. But do you know that also this morning you hold in your hand, if we had have lived over 3,000 years ago, an instrument of death? Oh, it's quite shocking, really. Thank goodness that we live in a different age, a different culture, and we have a different faith. Because we read of stoning in the Old Testament, and we see that God basically ordained it, and really, basically, as a deterrent for the sins that he found most, that affected the soul and the spirit of a person most. Most other sort of things that people had to do would be to remove themselves and to cleanse themselves and to take time. But the things like blaspheming, idolatry, murder, sexual sins, these were things that affected the people personally and corporately as well. And so, yes, he chose this as a means of a way for people to die. And we still read about it in the New Testament. In John 10, we read of Jesus where he's actually been kind of corralled along, and the people are actually holding stones and they're saying, we want to kill you because you're being blasphemous. But Jesus miraculously walks away. We read also in Acts of Stephen, of where he was eventually stoned to death, an awful way to die. But also, in John, we read about, and today it's where we're going to finish up, with the story of the woman caught in adultery. The weird thing in this story, if you have a look at, you know, as we read it, is that the men brought the woman to Jesus and made her stand in front of him when they knew that Jesus, there was nothing that Jesus could do. You know, this wasn't the right way to go about it, because there was a right way to prove that this person was guilty and therefore they needed to be stoned. Okay? They didn't do it because they wanted to see justice ensue. They wanted to do it because they wanted to trick Jesus and entrap him. But what was to happen instead was that they exposed the heart of the gospel message in such a beautiful and profound way. So we have these men who have brought this woman, and she's been caught in the act of adultery, and they bring her and they put her in front of Jesus. And they stand behind her, I imagine, with contempt and disgust. And they look at, they look at Jesus accusatorily. You know, they're standing at, looking at him. And what they want is they're demanding to know what he has to say about the situation. It's kind of like as they throw the law at him along with the woman. So what does Jesus have to say? Well, at this point in time, he says nothing. Because he doesn't have to say anything, because he's already mentioned what he thinks about this earlier. And I wonder if these guys had heard it and this was making them feel really angry. Don't judge another, or you too will be judged, and you'll be judged in the same way that you judge them. And why do you take the speck of sawdust out of your brother's eye when you've got this huge plank in your own? Wouldn't it be better for you to take the plank out of your eye so that you can see more clearly and help remove the speck out of your brother's eye? When Jesus had said these words back in what we know the Sermon on the Mount, he wasn't replacing the law, but bringing a fullness to it. And in doing so, it challenges us to live a deeper, a richer life, one that goes beyond the surface of looking and behaving the right way. He desires to write the law of love on our hearts so that we would choose to walk in the truth of the fullness of his commands. Now, I find this really interesting. I think, you know, Jesus, being fully man, could have stood up and basically ripped these men to shreds, because we know that he knows the heart and the mind and the spirit of all of mankind. And he could have done that. He could have shouted out across the rooftops. But no, he doesn't do that, because Jesus, being fully God, full of grace, covered these men along with the woman. So he didn't come to destroy mankind. He's come to save us. And then he does speak. He says, anyone who is without sin can throw the first stone at her. And he bends down and he starts to write words in the sand. We'll never know what those words are, but they must have been really powerful words, because those men who before, I imagine, who were full of rage and anger and self-righteousness, quietly slipped away. The law says that this woman should be stoned. But grace says to her, go now and leave your life of sin. The law says that I must prove and expose another's guilt. But grace says that Jesus, who was without sin, took on our sin so that we could be the righteousness of God. The law exposes, but grace covers. And then he says to this woman, go and sin no more. Leave your life of sin. It's kind of like he's taken this instrument of punishment, which is legally due to all of us because all have sinned, and he's exchanged it with forgiveness, righteousness, and grace. You know, whether we feel we may be like the Pharisee or like the woman, we are all the same. We have sinned. But the wonderful thing is that Jesus offers us forgiveness and healing. He offers us righteousness and grace. It is a beautiful exchange. He who was without sin took our sin so that we could be the righteousness of God, that we could live our life here to the fullness on into eternity. If I can invite the worship team up, please. And we're going to sing that song. I wonder if you could hold that stone in your hand. And this morning, I just wonder, what does it mean to you? Is it a reminder to not forget what God has done thus far? That God will strengthen us for today, and that we have hope and we have purpose and a promise which we will fulfill tomorrow. Or is it that the battle that, or that where you are this morning, it's been a battle. And yes, you've thrown everything at it and still found yourself wanting. When this morning God says, the battle is mine. Look to me. Look to Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith. The victory is found in him. Or is it this morning that grace, we need to remember grace. Grace has been given, and we can freely give grace as well. Whether we find ourselves the one pointing the fingers, or the one who the finger's being pointed at, Jesus covers us. We are covered by his love by his righteousness and by his grace, and we are healed and whole in him. So as we stand and sing the song, I pray that you would spend some time with him. We encourage you to hold and to take the stone with you and put it in a place where maybe someone will go, "What's that? Why have you got that there?" And you can say what this stone means to you this morning. God is good and he is mighty. He is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The battle is his. And I am his beloved, covered in love and grace.